Alexandrov had only once seen his senior commander, and then only at a distance. He was not a large man, but you didn't want him as a physical enemy in a small room. He was chewing on a cigar that had gone out seemingly hours before, and his blue eyes blazed.
"Who is this?" Sinyavsky demanded.
Then his face changed.
"Are you the famous Pasha?" he asked more respectfully. "Senior Sergeant Gogol of the Iron and Steel Division," the old man said with great dignity,
and a salute which Sinyavsky returned crisply.
"I understand you killed some Germans in your day. How many, Sergeant?" "Count for yourself, Comrade General," Gogol said, handing his rifle over.
"Damn," the general observed, looking at the notches, like those on the pistol of some American cowboy.
"I believe you really did it. But combat is a young man's game, Pavel Petrovich. Let me get you to a place of safety."
Gogol shook his head.
"This captain promised me one shot, or I would not have left my home."
"Is that a fact?" The commanding general of 265th Motor Rifle looked around.
"Captain Alexandrov, very well. We'll give our old comrade his one shot."
He pointed to a place on the map before him.
"This should be a good spot for you. And when you can, get him the hell away from here," Sinyavsky told the young man. "Head back this way to our lines. They'll be expecting you. Boy, you've done a fine job shadowing them all the way up. Your reward will be to see how we greet the bastards."
"Behind the reconnaissance element is a large force."
"I know. I've been watching them on TV for a day and a half. But our American friends have cut off their supplies. And we will stop them. And we will stop them right here."
Alexandrov checked the map reference. It looked like a good spot with a good field of fire, and best of all, an excellent route to run away on.
"How long?" he asked. 2 hours, I should think. Their main body is catching up with the screen. Your first job is to make their screen vehicles disappear."
"Yes, Comrade General, that we can do for you," the captain responded with enthusiasm. Sunrise found Marion Diggs in a strangely bizarre environment. Physically, the surroundings reminded him of Fort Carson, Colorado, with its rolling hills and patchy pine woods. But it was unlike America in its lack of paved roads or civilization, and that explained why the Chinese had invaded here. With little civilian population out here, there was no infrastructure or population base to provide for the area's defense. And that had made things a lot easier for John Chinaman. Diggs didn't mind it either. It was like his experience in the Persian Gulf. No non-combatants to get in the way, and that was good. But there were a lot of Chinese to get in the way. Mike Francisco's 1st Brigade had debouched into the main logistics area for the Chinese advance. The ground was carpeted with trucks and soldiers, but while most of them were armed, few were organized into cohesive tactical units, and that made all the difference. Colonel Miguel Francisco's brigade of 4 battalions had been organized for combat with the infantry and tank battalions integrated into unified battalion task groups of mixed tanks and Bradleys, and these were sweeping across the ground like a harvesting machine in Kansas in August. If it was painted green, it was shot. The monstrous Abrams main battle tanks moved over the rolling ground like creatures from Jurassic Park, alien, evil, and unstoppable, their gun turrets traversing left and right, but without firing their main guns. The real work was being done by the tank commanders and their M250 machine guns, which could turn any truck into an immobile collection of steel and canvas. Just a short burst into the engine made sure that the pistons would never move again, and the cargo in the back would remain where it was, for inspection by intelligence officers, or destruction by explosives carrying engineer troops who came behind the tanks in their Humvees. Some resistance was offered by the Chinese soldiers, but only by the dumb ones, and never for long. Even those with man-portable anti-tank weapons rarely got close enough to use them, and those few who popped up from wolf holes only scratched the paint on the tanks, and usually paid for their foolishness with their lives. At one point, a battalion of infantry did launch a deliberate attack, supported by mortars that forced the tank and Bradley crews to button up and reply with organized fire. 5 minutes of 155mm fire and a remorseless advance by the Bradleys, spitting fire from their chain guns and through the firing ports for the mounted infantry inside, made them look like fire-breathing dragons, and these dragons were not a sign of good luck for the Chinese soldiers. That battalion evaporated in 20 minutes, along with its dedicated but doomed commander. Intact enemy armored vehicles were rarely seen by the advancing 1st Brigade. Where it went, Apache attack helicopters had gone before, looking for targets for their Hellfire missiles, and killing them before the ground troops could get close. All in all, it was a perfect military operation, totally unfair in the balance of forces. It wasn't the least bit sporting, but a battlefield is not an Olympic stadium, and there were no uniformed officials to guard the supposed rules of fair play. The only exciting thing was the appearance of a Chinese Army helicopter, and two Apaches blazed after it and destroyed it with air-to-air missiles, dropping it in the Amur River close to the floating bridges, which were now empty of traffic, but not yet destroyed. "What have you learned, Wei?" Marshal Luo asked, when he emerged from the conference room he'd used for his nap. "The picture is still unclear in some respects, Comrade Minister," the general answered. "Then tell me what is clear," Luo ordered. "Very well. At sea we have lost a number of ships. This evidently includes our ballistic missile submarine and its escorting hunter submarine. Cause unknown. But their emergency beacons deployed and transmitted their programmed messages starting at about 0200 hours. Also lost are 7 surface warships of various types from our South Sea Fleet. Also 7 fleet bases were attacked by American aircraft, believed to be naval carrier aircraft, along with a number of surface-to-air missile and radar sites on the southeastern coast. We've succeeded in shooting down a number of American aircraft, but in a large fighter battle, we took serious losses to our fighter regiments in that region." "Is the American Navy attacking us?" Luo asked. "It appears that they are, yes," General Wei answered, choosing his words with care. "We estimate 4 of their aircraft carriers, judging by the number of aircraft involved. As I said, reports are that we handled them roughly, but our losses were severe as well." "What are their intentions?" the minister asked. "Unclear. They've done serious damage to a number of bases, and I doubt we have a single surface ship surviving at sea. Our Navy personnel have not had a good day," Wei concluded. "But that is not really a matter of importance." "The attack on the missile submarine is," Luo replied. "That is an attack on a strategic asset. That is something we must consider." He paused. "Go on, what else?" "General Qi of 65th Army is missing and presumed dead, along with all of his senior staff. We've made repeated attempts to raise him by radio with no result. The 191st Infantry Division was attacked last night by heavy forces of unknown identity. They sustained heavy losses due to artillery and aircraft, but 2 of their regiments report that they are holding their positions. The 735th Guards Infantry Regiment evidently took the brunt of the attack, and reports from there are fragmentary. The most serious news is from Harbin and Bayan. Enemy aircraft attacked all of the railroad bridges in both cities, and all of them took damage. Rail traffic north has been interrupted. We're trying now to determine how quickly it might be re-established."
"Is there any good news?" Marshal Luo asked.
"Yes, Comrade Minister. General Peng and his forces are getting ready now to resume their attack. We expect to have the Russian gold field in our control by midday," Wei answered, inwardly glad that he didn't have to say what had happened to the logistical train behind Peng and his 34th Shark Army. Too much bad news could get the messenger killed, and he was the messenger.
"I want to talk to Peng. Get him on the phone," Luo ordered.
"Telephone lines have been interrupted briefly, but we do have radio contact with him," Wei told his superior.
"Then get me Peng on the radio," Luo repeated his order.
"What is it, Hua?" Peng asked.
Couldn't he even take a piss without interruption?
Radio. It's the defense minister, his operations officer told him.
Wonderful, the general groused, heading back to his command track as he buttoned his fly. He ducked to get inside and lifted the microphone.
This is General Peng.
This is Marshal Luo. What is your situation? The voice asked through the static.
Comrade Marshal, we will be setting off in 10 minutes. We have still not made contact with the enemy, and our reconnaissance has seen no sizable enemy formations in our area. Have you developed any intelligence we can use?
Be advised we have aerial photography of Russian mechanized units to your west, probably division strength. I would advise you to keep your mechanized forces together and guard your left flank.
Yes, Comrade Marshal, I am doing that, Peng assured him.
The real reason he stopped every day was to allow his divisions to close up, keeping his fist tight. Better yet, 29th Taipei Group Army was right behind his if he needed support.
I recommend that 43rd Army be tasked to flank guard.
I will give the order, Luo promised.
How far will you go today?
Comrade Marshal, I will send a truckload of gold back to you this very evening.
Question. What is this I've heard about damage to our line of supply?
There was an attack last night on some railroad bridges in Harbin and Bayan, but nothing we can't fix.
Very well, Comrade Marshal. I must see to my dispositions.
Carry on, then. Out.
Peng set the microphone back in its holder.
Nothing he can't fix, he says.
You know what those bridges are like. You'd need a nuclear weapon to hurt them, Colonel Hua Chenggong observed confidently.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Peng stood, buttoned his tunic, and reached for a mug of morning tea.
Tell the advance guard to prepare to move out. I'm going up front this morning, Hua. I want to see this gold mine for myself.
How far up front? The operations officer asked.
With the lead elements. A good officer leads from the front, and I want to see how our people move. Our reconnaissance screen hasn't detected anything, has it?
Well, no, Comrade General, but...
But what? Peng demanded.
But a prudent commander leaves leading to lieutenants and captains, Hua pointed out.
Hua, sometimes you talk like an old woman, Peng chided.
There, Yefremov said. They took the bait.
It was just after midnight in Moscow, and the embassy of the People's Republic of China had most of its lights off, but not all. More to the point, three windows had their lights on, and their shades fully open, and they were all in a row. It was just as perfect as what the Americans called a sting operation. He'd stood over Suvorov's shoulder as he'd typed the message.
I have the pieces in place now. I have the pieces in place now. If you wish for me to carry out the operation, leave three windows in a row with the lights on and the windows fully open.
Yefremov had even had a television camera record the event, down to the point where the traitor Suvorov had tapped the enter key to send the letter to his Chink controller. And he'd gotten a TV news crew to record the event as well, because the Russian people seemed to trust the semi-independent media more than their government now, for some reason or other. Good, now they had proof positive that the Chinese government was conspiring to kill President Grushevoy. That would play well in the international press. And it wasn't an accident. The windows all belonged to the chief of mission in the PRC embassy, and he was, right now, asleep in his bed. They'd made sure of that by calling him on the phone 10 minutes earlier.
So, what do we do now?
We tell the president, and then, I expect, we tell the TV news people. And we probably spare Suvorov's life. I hope he likes it in the labor camp.
What about the killings?
Yefremov shrugged.
He only killed a pimp and a whore. No great loss, is it?
Senior Lieutenant Komonov had not exactly enjoyed his last 4 days, but at least they'd been spent profitably training his men to shoot. The reservists, now known as Boyar Force, had spent them doing gunnery, and they'd fired 4 basic loads of shells over that time, more than any of them had ever shot on active duty, but the Nevers depot had been well stocked with shells. Officers assigned to the formation by Far East Command told them that the Americans had moved by to their south the previous day, and that their mission was to slide north of them and do it today. Only 30 kilometers stood between them and the Chinese, and he and his men were ready to pay them a visit. The throaty rumble of his own diesel engine was answered by the thunder of 200 others, and Boyar started moving northeast through the hills. Peng and his command section raced forward, calling ahead on their radios to clear the way, and the military police troops doing traffic control waved them through. Soon they reached the command section of the 302nd Armored, his leading fist formation, commanded by Major General Gay Lee, a squat officer whose incipient corpulence made him look rather like one of his tanks. "Are you ready, Gay?" Peng asked. The man was well named for his task. Gay had the primary meaning of spear. "We are ready," the tanker replied. "My leading regiments are turning over and straining at the leash." "Well, shall we observe from the front together?" "Yes." Gay jumped aboard his own command tank. He preferred this to a personnel carrier, despite the poorer radios, and led the way forward. Peng immediately established a direct radio connection with his subordinate. "How far to the front?"
3 kilometers. The reconnaissance people are moving now, and they are another 2 kilometers ahead."
"Lead on, Gay," Peng urged. "I want to see that gold mine." It was a good spot, Alexandrov thought, unless the enemy got his artillery set up sooner than expected, and he hadn't seen or heard Chinese artillery yet. He was on the fairly steep reverse side of an open slope that faced south, rather like a lengthy ramp, perhaps 3 kilometers in length, not unlike a practice shooting range at a regimental base. The sun was starting to crest the eastern horizon, and they could see now, which always made soldiers happy. Pasha had stolen a spare coat and laid his rifle across it, standing in the open top hatch of the BRM, looking through the telescopic sight of his rifle. "So, what was it like to be a sniper against the Germans?" Alexandrov asked, once he'd settled himself in.
"It was good hunting. I tried to stick to killing officers. You have more effect on them that way," Gogol explained. "A German private? Well, he was just a man. An enemy, of course, but he probably had no more wish to be on a battlefield than I did. But an officer, those were the ones who directed the killing of my comrades. And when you got one of them, you confused the enemy."
"How many?"
"Lieutenants, 18. Captains, 12. Only 3 majors, but 9 colonels. I decapitated 9 Fritz regiments. Then, of course, sergeants and machine gun crews, but I don't remember them as well as the colonels." "I can still see every one of those, my boy," Gogol said, tapping the side of his head.
"Did they ever try to shoot at you?"
"Mainly with artillery," Pasha answered. "A sniper affects the morale of a unit. Men do not like being hunted like game. But the Germans didn't use snipers as skillfully as we did, and so they answered me with field guns."
"That," he admitted, "could be frightening, but it really told me how much the Fritzes feared me," Pavel Petrovich concluded with a cruel smile.
"There," Buikov pointed, "just off the trees to the left."
"Ah," Gogol said, looking through his gun sight. "Ah, yes."
Alexandrov laid his binoculars on the fleeting shape. It was the vertical steel side on a Chinese infantry carrier, one of those he'd been watching for some days now. He lifted his radio.
"This is Green Wolf 1, enemy in sight, map reference 285-906. 1 infantry track coming north. Will advise."
"Understood, Green Wolf," the radio crackled back.
"Now we must just be patient," Fedor Ilyich said.
He stretched, touching the camouflage net that he'd ordered set up the moment they'd arrived in this place. To anyone more than 300 meters away, he and his men were just part of the hill crest. Next to him, Sergeant Buikoff lit a cigarette, blowing out the smoke.
"That is bad for us," Gogol advised. "It alerts the game."
"They have little noses," Buikoff replied.
"Yes, and the wind is in our favor," the old hunter conceded.
"Lordy, lordy," Major Tucker observed. "They've bunched up some." It was Grace Kelly again, looking down on the battlefield, to be, like Pallas Athena, looking down on the plains of Troy. And about as pitilessly. The ground had opened up a little, and the corridor they moved across was a good 3 kilometers wide. Enough for a battalion of tanks to travel line abreast. A regiment in columns of battalions. 3 lines of 35 tanks each, with tracked infantry carriers interspersed with them. Colonels Aliyev and Tolkunov stood behind him, speaking in Russian over their individual telephones to the 265th Motor Rifles command post. In the night, the entire 201st had finally arrived, plus leading elements of the 80th and 44th. There were now nearly 3 divisions to meet the advancing Chinese, and included in that were 3 full divisional artillery sets, plus, Tucker saw for the first time, a shitload of attack helicopters sitting on the ground 30 kilometers back from the point of expected contact. Joe Chink was driving into a motherfucker of an ambush. Then a shadow crossed under Grace Kelly, out of focus, but something moving fast. It was 2 squadrons of F-16C fighter bombers, and they were armed with Smart Pigs. That was the nickname for JSOW. The Joint Standoff Weapon. The night before, other F-16s, the CG version, the new and somewhat downsized version of the F-4G Wild Weasel, had gone into China and struck at the line of border radar transmitters, hitting them with HARM anti-radar missiles and knocking most of them off the air. That denied the Chinese foreknowledge of the inbound strike. They had been guided by 2 E-3B Sentry aircraft, and protected by 3 squadrons of F-15C Eagle air superiority fighters in the event some Chinese fighters appeared again to die. But there had been little such fighter activity in the past 36 hours. The Chinese fighter regiments had paid a bloody price for their pride, and were staying close to home in what appeared to be a defense mode, on the principle that if you weren't attacking, then you were defending. In fact, they were doing little but flying standing patrols over their own bases. That's how thoroughly they had been whipped by American and Russian fighters. And that left the air in American and Russian control, which was going to be bad news for the People's Liberation Army. The F-16s were at 30,000 feet, holding to the east. They were several minutes early for the mission, and circled while awaiting word to attack. Some concertmaster was stage-managing this, they all thought. They hoped he didn't break his little baton-stick thing.
"Getting closer," Pasha observed with studied nonchalance.
"Range?" Alexandrov asked the men down below in the track.
2,100 meters within range," Buikoff reported from inside the gun turret. "The Fox and the Gardner approach, comrade captain."
"Leave them be for the moment, Boris Yevgenievich."
"As you say, comrade captain."
Buikoff was comfortable with the no-shoot rule, for once.
"How much farther to the reconnaissance screen?" Peng asked.
2 more kilometers, Gay replied over the radio.
"But that might not be a good idea."
"Gay, have you turned into an old woman?" Peng asked lightly.
"Comrade, it is the job of lieutenants to find the enemy, not the job of senior generals," the division commander replied in a reasonable voice.
"Is there any reason to believe the enemy is nearby?"
"We are in Russia, Peng. They're here somewhere."
"He is correct, comrade general," Colonel Hua Chenggong pointed out to his commander.
"Rubbish. Go forward. Tell the reconnaissance element to stop and await us," Peng ordered.
"A good commander leads from the front," he announced over the radio.
"Oh, shit," Gay observed in his tank. "Peng wants to show off his Gigi. Move out.
he ordered his driver, a captain. His entire crew was made of officers. Let's lead the Emperor to the recon screen. The brand-new T-98 tank surged forward, throwing up two rooster tails of dirt as it accelerated. General Gay was in the commander's hatch, with the major acting as gunner, a duty he practiced diligently because it was his job to keep his general alive in the event of contact with the enemy. For the moment, it meant going ahead of the senior general with blood in his eye. "Why did they stop?" Buikov asked. The PLA tracks had suddenly halted 900 meters off, all five of them, and now the crews dismounted, manifestly to take a stretch, and five of them lit up smokes. "They must be waiting for something," the captain thought aloud. Then he got on the radio. "Green Wolf here. The enemy has halted about a kilometer south of us. They're just sitting still." "Have they seen you?" "No, they've dismounted to take a piss, looks like, just standing there. We have them in range, but I don't want to shoot until they're closer," Alexandrov reported. "Very well, take your time. There's no hurry here. They're walking into the parlor very nicely."
"Understood. Out." He set the mic down.
"Is it time for morning break?"
"They haven't been doing that the last 4 days, Comrade Captain," Buikov reminded his boss. "They appear relaxed enough."
"I could kill any of them now," Gogol said. "But they're all privates, except for that one."
"That's the fox. He's a lieutenant, likes to run around a lot. The other officer is the gardener. He likes playing with plants," Buikov told the old man.
"Killing a lieutenant's not much better than killing a corporal," Gogol observed. "There's too many of them."
"What's this?" Buikov said from his gunner seat. "Tank. Enemy tank coming around the left edge, range 5,000.
"I see it," Alexandrov reported.
"Just one? Only one tank?"
"Oh, all right, there's a carrier with it."
"It's a command track. Look at all those antennas," Buikov called. The gunner's sight was more powerful than Alexandrov's binoculars. The captain couldn't confirm that for another minute or so.
"Oh, yes, that's a command track, all right. I wonder who's in it."
"There they are," the driver called back. "The reconnaissance section, 2 kilometers ahead, Comrade General."
"Excellent," Peng observed, standing up to look out of the top of his command track with his binoculars. Good Japanese ones from Nikon.
There was Gay in his command tank, 30 meters off to the right, protecting him as though he were a good dog outside the palace of some ancient nobleman. Peng couldn't see anything to be concerned about. It was a clear day, with some puffy white clouds at 3,000 meters or so. If there were American fighters up there, he wasn't going to worry about them. Besides, they'd done no ground attacking that he'd heard about, except to hit those bridges back at Harbin. And one might as well attack a mountain as those things, Peng was sure. He had to hold on to the sill of the hatch lest the pitching of the vehicle smash him against it. It was a track specially modified for senior officers, but no one had thought to make it safer to stand in, he thought sourly. He wasn't some peasant private who could smash his head with no consequence. Well, in any case, it was a good day to be a soldier, in the field, leading his men. A fair day and no enemy in sight. "Pull up alongside the reconnaissance track," he ordered his driver.
"Who the hell is this?" Captain Alexandrov wondered aloud. "Four big antennas. At least a division commander," Buikov thought aloud. "My 30 will settle his hash. No, no, let's let Pasha have him if he gets out."
Gogol had anticipated that. He was resting his arms on the steel top of the BRM, tucking the rifle in tight to his shoulder. The only thing in his way was the loose weave of the camouflage netting, and that wasn't an obstacle to worry about, the old marksman was sure.
"Stopping to see the fox?" Buikov said next.
"Looks that way," the captain agreed.
"Comrade General," the young lieutenant called in surprise.
"Where's the enemy, boy?"
Peng asked loudly in return.
"General, we haven't seen much this morning. Some tracks in the ground, but not even any of that for the past 2 hours."
"Nothing at all?"
"Not a thing," the lieutenant replied.
"Well, I thought there'd be something around."
Peng put his foot in the leather stirrup and climbed to the top of his command vehicle.
"It's a general. Has to be. Look at that clean uniform,"
Boykov told the others, as he slewed his turret around to center his sight on the man 800 meters away. It was the same in any army. Generals never got dirty.
"Pasha?" Alexandrov asked.
"Ever kill an enemy general before?"
"No,"
Gogol admitted, drawing the rifle in very tight and allowing for the range.
"Better to go to that ridge line, but our orders were to stop at once," the lieutenant told the general.
"That's right," Peng agreed. He took out his Nikon binoculars and trained them on the ridge, perhaps 800 meters off. Nothing to see except for that one bush. Then there was a flash.
"Yes,"
Gogol said the moment the trigger broke. 2 seconds about for the bullet to... They'd never hear the report of the shot over the sound of their diesel engines, but Colonel Waugh heard the strange wet thud, and his head turned to see General Peng's face twist into surprise rather than pain. And Peng grunted from the sharp blow to the center of his chest, and then his hands started coming down, pulled by the additional weight of the binoculars. And then his body started down, falling off the top of the command track, through the hatch, into the radio-filled interior.
"That's got him," Gogol said positively. "He's dead."
He almost added that it might be fun to skin him and lay his hide in the river for a final swim and a gold coating. But no, you only did that to wolves, not people. Not even Chinese.
"Boykov, take those tracks."
"Gladly, comrade captain." And the sergeant squeezed the trigger, and the big machine gun spoke.
They hadn't seen or heard the shot that had killed Peng, but there was no mistaking the machine cannon that fired now. 2 of the reconnaissance tracks exploded at once, but then everything started moving and fire was returned.
"Major!"
General Gay called.
"Loading heat!"
The gunner punched the right button, but the autoloader, never as fast as a person, took its time to ram the projectile and then the propellant case into the breech.
"Back us up!" Alexandrov ordered loudly.
The diesel engine was already running, and the BRM's transmission set in reverse. The corporal in the driver's seat floored the pedal and the carrier jerked backward. The suddenness of it nearly lost Gogol over the side, but Alexandrov grabbed his arm and dragged him down inside, tearing his skin in the process.
"Go north," the captain ordered next. "I got 3 of the bastards," Boykov said.
Then the sky was rent by a crash overhead. Something had gone by too fast to see, but not too fast to hear.
"That tank gunner knows his business," Alexandrov observed. "Corporal, get us out of here."
"Working on it, comrade captain."
"Green Wolf to command," the captain said next into the radio.
"Yes, Green Wolf, report."
"We just killed 3 enemy tracks, and I think we got a senior officer. Pasha, Sergeant Gogol, that is, killed a Chinese general officer, or so it appeared."
"He was a general, all right," Boykov agreed. "The shoulder boards were pure gold, and that was a command track with 4 big radio antennas."
"Understood. What are you doing now, Green Wolf?"
"We are getting the fuck away. I think we'll be seeing more chinks soon."
"Agreed, Green Wolf. Proceed to Divisional CP. Out."
"Yuri Andreevich, you will have heavy contact in a few minutes. What is your plan?"
"I want to volley-fire my tanks before firing my artillery. Why spoil the surprise, Gennady?"
Sinyavsky asked cruelly.
"We are ready for them here."
"Understood. Good luck, Yuri."
"And what of the other missions?"
"Boyar is moving now, and the Americans are about to deploy their magical pigs. If you can handle the leading Chinese elements, those behind ought to be roughly handled."
"You can rape their daughters for all I care, Gennady."
"That is nekulturni, Yuri."
"Perhaps their wives," he suggested, adding,
We are watching you on the television now.
Then I will smile for the cameras, Sinyavsky promised.
The orbiting F-16 fighters were under the tactical command of Major General Gus Wallace, but he at the moment was under the command, or at least operating under the direction, of a Russian, General Colonel Gennady Bondarenko, who was in turn guided by the action of this skinny young Major Tucker and Grace Kelly, a soulless drone hovering over the battlefield.
There they go, General, Tucker said, as the leading Chinese echelons resumed their drive north.
I think it is time, then. He looked to Colonel Aliyev, who nodded agreement.
Bondarenko lifted the satellite phone.
General Wallace?
I'm here.
Please release your aircraft.
Roger that. Out.
And Wallace shifted phone receivers.
Eagle One, this is Rough Rider. Execute, execute, execute. Acknowledge.
Roger that, sir. Copy your order to execute. Executing now. Out.
And the colonel on the lead AWACS shifted to a different frequency.
Cadillac lead, this is Eagle One. Execute your attack. Over.
Roger that, the colonel heard.
Going down now. Out.
The F-16s had been circling above the isolated clouds. Their threat receivers chirped a little bit, reporting the emissions of SAM radars somewhere down there. But the types indicated couldn't reach this high, and their jammer pods were all on anyway. On command, the sleek fighters changed course for the battlefield far below and to their west. Their GPS locators told them exactly where they were, and they also knew where their targets were, and the mission became a strictly technical exercise. Under the wings of each aircraft were the smart pigs, four to the fighter, with 48 fighters that came to 192 JSOWs. Each of these was a canister 13 feet long and not quite 2 feet wide, filled with blue 108 submunitions, 20 per container. The fighter pilots punched the release triggers, dropped their bombs, and then angled for home, letting the robots do the rest of the work. The Dark Star tapes would later tell them how they'd done. The smart pigs separated from the fighters, extended their own little wings to guide themselves the rest of the way to the target area. They knew this information, having been programmed by the fighters, and were now able to follow guidance from their own GPS receivers. This they did, acting in accordance with their own onboard mini-computers, until each reached a spot 5,000 feet over their designated segment of the battlefield. They didn't know that this was directly over the real estate occupied by the Chinese 29th Type A Group Army and its three heavy divisions, which included nearly 700 main battle tanks, 300 armored personnel carriers, and 100 mobile guns. That made a total of roughly 1,000 targets for the nearly 4,000 descending submunitions. But the falling bomblets were guided too, and each had a seeker looking for heat of the sort radiated by an operating tank, personnel carrier, self-propelled gun, or truck. There were a lot of them to look for. No one saw them coming. They were small, no larger really than a common crow, and falling rapidly. They were also painted white, which helped them blend into the morning sky. Each had a rudimentary steering mechanism, and at an altitude of 2,000 feet they started looking for and homing in on targets. Their downward speed was such that a minor deflection of their control vanes was sufficient to get them close, and close meant straight down. They exploded in bunches almost in the same instant. Each contained a pound and a half of high explosive, the heat from which melted the metal casing, which then turned into a projectile. The process was called self-forging, which blazed downward at a speed of 10,000 feet per second. The armor on the top of a tank is always the thinnest, and five times the thickness would have made no difference. Of the 921 tanks on the field, 762 took hits, and the least of these destroyed the vehicle's diesel engine. Those less fortunate took hits through the turret, which killed the crews at once and/or ignited the ammunition storage, converting each armored vehicle into a small man-fabricated volcano.
Just that quickly, three mechanized divisions were changed into one badly shaken and disorganized brigade. The infantry carriers fared no better. And it was worst of all for the trucks, most of them carrying ammunition or other flammable supplies. All in all, it took less than 90 seconds to turn 29th Type A Group Army into a thinly spread junkyard and funeral pyre.
"Holy God," Ryan said, "is this for real?"
"Seeing is believing. Jack, when they came to me with the idea for JSOW, I thought it had to be something from a science fiction book. Then they demoed the submunitions out at China Lake, and I thought, Jesus, we don't need the Army or the Marines anymore. Just send over some F-18s and then a brigade of trucks full of body bags and some ministers to pray over them. Eh, Mickey?"
"It's some capability," General Moore agreed. He shook his head. "Damn, just like the tests." "Okay, what's happening next?"
Next was just off the coast near Guangzhou. Two Aegis cruisers, Mobile Bay and Princeton, plus the destroyers Fletcher, Fife, and John Young, steamed in line-ahead formation out of the morning fog and turned broadside to the shore. There was actually a decent beach at this spot. There was nothing much behind it, just a coastal defense missile battery that the fighter bombers had immolated a few hours before. To finish that job, the ships trained their guns to port and let loose a barrage of 5-inch shells. The crack and thunder of the gunfire could be heard on shore, as was the shriek of the shells passing overhead, and the explosions of the detonations. That included one missile that the bombs of the previous night had missed, plus the crew getting it ready for launch. People living nearby saw the gray silhouettes against the morning sky, and many of them got on the telephone to report what they saw. But being civilians, they reported the wrong thing, of course. It was just after 9 in the morning in Beijing when the Politburo began its emergency session. Some of those present had enjoyed a restful night's sleep, and then been disturbed by the news that came over the phone at breakfast. Those better informed had hardly slept at all past 3 in the morning, and, though more awake than their colleagues, were not in a happier mood.
"Well, Luo, what is happening?" Interior Minister Tong Jie asked. "Our enemies counterattacked last night. This sort of thing we must expect, of course," he admitted in as low-key a voice as circumstances permitted.
"How serious were these counterattacks?" Tong asked.
"The most serious involved some damage to railroad bridges in Harbin and Bayan, but repairs are underway."
"I hope so. The repair effort will require some months," Chan Kun interjected.
"Who said that?" Luo demanded harshly.
"Marshal, I supervised the construction of two of those bridges. This morning I called the division superintendent for our state railroad in Harbin. All 6 of them have been destroyed. The piers on both sides of the river are totally wrecked. It will take over a month just to clear the debris."
"I admit this surprised me. Those bridges were very sturdily built, but the division superintendent tells me they are quite beyond repair."
"And who is this defeatist?" Luo demanded.
"He is a loyal party member of long standing and a very competent engineer, whom you will not threaten in my presence," Chan shot back.
"There is room in this building for many things, but there is not room here for a lie."
"Come now, Chan," Zhang Hansan soothed. "We need not have that sort of language here. Now, Luo, how bad is it really?"
"I have army engineers heading there now to make a full assessment of the damage and to commence repairs. I am confident that we can restore service shortly. We have skilled bridging engineers, you know."